Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Worries about China's faltering economic growth continue to fuel falling stock and oil prices around the world. U.S. stock markets plunged at the open with the Dow off nearly 5% in the first few minutes of trading. In later trading, key U.S. indexes saw more moderate losses of around 3%. In Asia, Shanghai's stock index plunged more than 8%. Japan's main market lost more than 4%, and Hong Kong was down more than 5%. Key European indexes were off 4% or more. Prices for many commodities also declined, with the price of crude oil off by more than 4% to hit the lowest price in more than 6 years. China's growing economy has been a major market for commodities. A series of economic shocks, including a falling stock market and a surprise devaluation of the currency, have made investors question the health and growth of the world's second largest economy. South Korean President Park Geun-hye Monday publicly demanded that North Korea make amends for recent provocations, as ongoing high-level inter-Korean talks seem unable to reach a diplomatic settlement to avert war in the peninsula. We need a clear apology and measures to prevent a recurrence of these provocations and tense situation. Otherwise, this government will take the appropriate steps and continue its loudspeaker broadcast, said President Park at a meeting of her top aides. The emergency talks taking place at the Panmunjom Truce Village on the inter-Korean border began Saturday, shortly after Pyongyang issued deadline expired for Seoul to halt cross-border audio broadcasts into the north or face military attacks. The negotiations have now continued for 3 days without any sign of progress. This is VOA News. Amnesty International has accused Burundian security agencies of detaining anti-government protesters and beating them to extract so-called confessions and silence dissent. For VOA, Mohamed Youssef reports.
A report titled Just Tell Me What to Confess To says authorities are responsible for acts of torture and other ill treatment against people arrested after protests erupted in Burundi in April. That's when President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he will seek a third term, angering opponents who said he was violating constitutional term limits. Amnesty's Deputy Regional Director, Sarah Jackson, listed some of the accusations.
The intelligence service used iron bars to beat detainees. The police service used electric wires and batons to severely beat detainees.
Amnesty is calling on Burundian authorities to act against officers involved in the torture and abuse of detainees. Mohamed Youssef for VOA News, Nairobi.
French President François Hollande on Monday bestowed the Legion of Honor, France's highest decoration, on a Briton and three Americans who subdued a heavily armed gunman aboard a high-speed train on Friday. At a ceremony in Paris, Mr. Hollande pinned medals on the chests of Briton Chris Norman and Americans Spencer Stone, Alex Garlatos, and Anthony Sadler. He said their actions last week in the face of terror provided a message of courage, solidarity, and hope. The president also honored a French citizen who first discovered the gunman as the train sped toward Paris. The head of UNESCO has called destruction by Islamic State militants in the ancient Syrian city of Palmyra a war crime. On Sunday, militants blew up the 2,000-year-old Baal Shamin Temple nearly a week after beheading Khalid Assad, archaeologist and former head of antiquities in Palmyra, who spent decades preserving the site. IS fighters captured the historic town in May, executing more than 200 people in and around Palmyra, sparking fears for the local community and the UNESCO site. Thousands of troops marched in Ukraine's capital on Monday to mark the 24th anniversary of the country's independence from what was then the Soviet Union. Soldiers who fought the government's campaign against Russia-backed separatists in eastern Ukraine marched through central Kiev carrying rifles. They were cheered by civilians, many wearing the country's national dress of embroidered shirts. This year's parade did not include the heavy military hardware seen in previous ones. Nearly 7,000 people have died since fighting erupted in April of 2014. I'm Bob Doty, reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The United Nations envoy to Somalia, Nicholas Kay, is criticizing an effort by some Somali lawmakers to impeach the president. He says that with an election coming up and Al-Shabaab militants still active, Somalia cannot lose time to the political bickering that has brought down governments in the past.
That's VOA's Mohamed Yusuf reporting. Details next.
Also in the news, France's President Francois Hollande and Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel plan to meet today to hammer out long overdue European Union quotas for thousands of migrants and refugees.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from East Africa, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the United Nations envoy to Somalia, Nicholas Kay, is criticizing an effort by some Somali lawmakers to impeach their president. Kay says with a national election coming up and Al-Shabaab militants still active, Somalia cannot afford to lose time to the kind of political bickering that has brought down Somali governments in the past. Mohamed Yusuf reports.
In recent days, members of Somalia's parliament have been working around the clock to impeach President Hassan Sheikh Mahamud. The lawmakers accuse him of violating the constitution. The crisis has the international community worried that Somalia may not be able to hold national elections scheduled for next year. In an interview with VOA, UN envoy Nicholas Kay says that while the UN respects the right of any parliament to hold institutions to account, Somalia cannot afford to lose more time on another political crisis.
We also recognise that the United Nations Security Council has expressed a very clear view that Somalia should have an electoral process in 2016. There should be no extension of mandates. And from where I sit, it's very difficult to see how an impeachment motion will allow those targets to be met, because of the delay and protracted crisis that it would cause.
Political disputes, often tied to power struggles and clan rivalries, have brought down several Somali presidents and prime ministers over the past decade. The current crisis began when some legislators called for the president to step down for failing to address growing insecurity and the killing of several lawmakers by Al-Shabaab. Many Somalis say they hope that in the 2016 election, they will have a chance to elect leaders of their choice. But Kay says that seems increasingly unlikely. The envoy calls on Somali government institutions to keep functioning and work on the priorities they set for themselves, like the constitutional review process, which he says are crucial to state building and good governance. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
France's President François Hollande and Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel plan to meet today to hammer out long overdue European Union quotas for 40,000 migrants and refugees. The meetings come as an estimated 7,000 migrants cross the Macedonian border into Serbia. The migrant rush across Serbia's border today came after Macedonia lifted its blockade when thousands of migrants stormed past Macedonian police. Germany expected a record 750,000 asylum seekers to arrive this year. In related news, two migrants drowned today in the Aegean Sea and five others are missing after a small craft capsized off the coast of Turkey. The vessel was headed for the Greek island of Lesbos. The islands of the Aegean have been inundated with migrants in recent weeks. Most are refugees from the Syrian war who sailed from nearby Turkey and were headed for Macedonia en route to the EU. Meanwhile, the Italian Navy rescued more than 4,400 migrants in the Mediterranean, the highest number in a single day since the migrant crisis began last year.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiye Suheeb, 10 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The United Nations envoy to Somalia, Nicholas Kay, is criticizing an effort by some Somali lawmakers to impeach the nation's president. And France's President François Hollande and Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel plan to meet today to hammer out long overdue European Union quotas for the thousands of migrants and refugees. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
In more developments around the continent, the Nigerian government denies that the armed gunmen who attacked the convoy of the Army's chief of staff were members of the militant group Boko Haram. The gunmen attacked the convoy of Lieutenant General Tukur Boratai on Friday. Boratai was unarmed, but one soldier was killed and several were wounded. A military spokesman identified 10 dead and 5 captives as members of the Boko Haram. The general was on a 4-hour drive from Maiduguri to a town near the border with Cameroon when the convoy's advance team was attacked. Boratai is a native on Borno State in the north. Since his appointment, his hometown has been attacked several times. In Chad, sources say the military chiefs of 5 countries have met in N'Djamena and agreed on the deployment of more than 8,000 troops against Boko Haram forces. They identified command post in Bagen, Nigeria, and along the Cameroon border with Gambaru and Gwoza. The multinational forces headquarters in N'Djamena is not yet operational.
Outbreaks of religious violence have damaged and divided the northern Nigerian city of Kaduna for years, but at an interfaith service, religious leaders from both communities came together to mark what they hope will be a new era of tolerance. Chris Stein reports with Ibrahima Yakubu in Kaduna.
About 10 times in recent years, mobs have set fire to the Evangelical Church of West Africa in Kaduna's Tudu Nfawa neighborhood. On Sunday night, Muslims and Christians sat together in the pews for an interfaith service meant to mark an end to years of conflict between the two communities. Reverend Yunusu Madu is the general overseer of the church.
The essence of today's service is to tell the world that peace is possible, and that Christians and Muslims can coexist. So we have called our Muslim friends so that we can come and worship together.
Kaduna and the state that shares its name are religiously mixed, with Muslims dominating the city and the state's northern half, and Christians dominating the southern part. Clashes between the two communities break out periodically. One of the bloodiest came after the 2011 presidential election, when rioting across Nigeria left 800 people dead. Many of the deaths happened in Kaduna. Nigeria this year elected a new president, Muhammadu Buhari, and religious leaders in Kaduna say it's time to put the rioting behind them. Abubakar Miki is a youth leader in the area around the church. He is offered to protect the church, even though he's a Muslim.
Well, this is a stepping stone, by the grace of God. In doing this, I project it like in 5 years' time, things will be far better than what we are in the past.
Nigeria's approximately 173 million people are about evenly split between Muslims and Christians. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
Well, 10 years ago, Hurricane Katrina slammed into the southern U.S. state of Louisiana, killing 1,800, displacing more than 1 million others, and causing $110 billion in damage. Economics professor says the lessons learned from Katrina should be applied elsewhere in the world, where tens of millions of people live in coastal areas. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
About 60 million poor people live in low elevation zones, 10 meters or less above sea level. It means they're particularly vulnerable to large storms and rising seas. They're concentrated in 15 countries: Nigeria, Senegal, Mozambique, India, Bangladesh, Myanmar, and Cambodia, as well as Pakistan, Iraq, Brazil, China, Indonesia, the Philippines, Vietnam, and Thailand. About 2.5 billion people live within 100 kilometers of the coast. Most are in developing countries. In 2005, Hurricane Katrina wreaked havoc not only on Louisiana, but along much of the Gulf of Mexico. University of Wyoming professor Edward Barbier says Katrina showed how important it is to have a coastal management strategy. He says it addresses two types of impacts.
One type of impact is the short-term natural disasters that we see routinely, such as hurricanes, storm surges, and so forth. And the second is the long-term consequences of climate change for our coasts, such as sea level rise, storm intensification, saltwater intrusion, and coastal erosion.
Barbier was part of a science and engineering board that worked on the 2012 Coastal Master Plan for Louisiana. He says besides addressing the immediate and longer-term impact threats, it contained three important elements.
One is gray infrastructure, the other is green infrastructure, and the third is social infrastructure. Gray infrastructure are the conventional engineered solutions to protecting the coast, such as building seawalls, dikes, and levees, and so forth. The second type of infrastructure is the green infrastructure. There's been tremendous loss of coastal habitats, such as marshes and coral reefs and oyster reefs, due to population change, economic development, and, of course, climate change.
Barbier says there's now an emphasis on revitalizing and restoring this green infrastructure as a natural coastal defense.
And then the third thing that's very important is to involve coastal communities, politicians, stakeholders, business people, and so forth in the design and implementation of these plans. And by building social infrastructure, not only do you improve the capacity of local communities to understand the consequences of not doing these plans and the need for them, but also to gain popular support for this long-term coastal planning strategy.
He says many developing countries do not have such plans in place.
Developing countries are seeing tremendous amount of development of their coastlines, both for economic development as well as for absorbing more and more people. And the consequences are that there are many populations in low-lying coastal areas of developing countries that are highly vulnerable to both natural hazards such as hurricanes as well as long-term effects of climate change.
Here in the United States, coastal areas are prime real estate, where much housing and development has taken place.
Hurricane Katrina, Hurricane Sandy in 2012 brought home to the United States many people that this trade-off has to be dealt with, and we have to think carefully about building along coastlines and being more vulnerable as a consequence. In developing countries, what we're seeing is an emphasis on economic development, and the coastlines are at the forefront of economic development. But they're also at the forefront of climate change and natural hazards.
The low elevation zones are the first to flood in heavy rains or a storm surge.
These are the areas that are going to be most inundated gradually due to sea level rise due to climate change, as well as saltwater intrusion, which affects agriculture in coastal areas and fisheries, of course, and also storm intensification.
Predicting how much seas will rise due to climate change is difficult, and projections vary. For example, National Geographic says forecasts range from less than a meter to more than 2 meters by the end of the century. That's enough to cause major problems for coastal cities and communities in the United States. National Geographic also says predictions get more dire if there's a complete meltdown of the Greenland ice sheet. Now, as sea levels rise, so does the world's population. The United Nations predicts that by the year 2100, there will be more than 11 billion people on the planet.
There is a lot of evidence to suggest that if current trends continue, we're going to see people living within coastal areas, that is within 100 kilometers of coast, grow from 200 million to over 400 million by the end of the century, which means more people who will be vulnerable. Also, incredible growth of cities, many of which are going to be in coastal low-lying areas, which will also be vulnerable.
Professor Barbier says the Indian Ocean tsunami in 2004 Hurricanes Katrina and Rita in 2005, Hurricane Sandy in 2012, and Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines in 2013 have provided enough evidence that coastal areas are at risk. Barbier has written a commentary in the journal Nature entitled Hurricane Katrina's Lessons for the World. He proposes that some of the billions of dollars UN member states have allocated for climate adaptation be used for coastal management strategies. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
In Zimbabwe, environmentalists are up in arms about the construction of shopping malls and residential housing on wetlands. The critics say the new developments will affect water supplies in urban areas. Authorities say rural to urban migration puts pressure on the country's urban land, resulting in the buildings on wetlands. As Sebastian Mumfu reports from Harare, environmentalists say if the trend continues, the city of Harare will run dry or will need more money to purify its water from open sources.
This is Monaville Flail, a 10-minute drive southwest of Harare's downtown, one of the few remaining wetlands in Zimbabwe's capital city. The place is mainly covered by green grass and a few trees, unlike other parts of the city. Officials say there are more than 250 species of birds here, some which travel from other parts of the world. Buildings, houses, or upscale shopping malls have covered other swampy areas. Harare's population has more than doubled in the past 10 years and is estimated at more than 2 million. Most of the increase is due to rural-urban migration. Another mall, dubbed Southern Africa's biggest, is set to shape up on wetlands in a posh suburb of Borodale, east of Harare. Jimmy Muropa, a conservation field officer, is worried by this development.
We are not against any form of development, but what we are basically saying is that those malls or houses should be actually properly sited way on higher ground where it is appropriate. We are for development, but on appropriate ground. Simple.
Scientists say wetlands purify and store water, which they gradually release into rivers and lakes. Harare Residents Trust says Zimbabwe's water rates are now high because of the destruction of wetlands. Precious Shumba is the head of the trust.
The monitoring framework is very weak. The Environment Management Agency does not follow laid down procedures when it comes to approval of buildings. There is so much corruption. There is no monitoring. The only relief that is available to EMA and the council is to charge penalties for violations, but they are not stopping, meaning to say our wetlands will continue to go.
Corruption has not been proven. The Environment Management Agency is a government body mandated to ensure sustainable use of the environment in Zimbabwe. Environment Agency spokesman Steady Kangata said his organization was trying to spread awareness of the importance of not constructing on wetlands. He dismissed allegations that Harare is lax on wetlands laws.
The Zimbabwean laws are very comprehensive when it comes to wetlands. Yes, Zimbabwe, we are part of the Ramsar Convention pertaining to the proper utilization of wetlands. And we have even gone further to domesticate the provisions of the Ramsar Convention. Wetlands are protected areas. But in the urban setup, you would find that there is pressure for infrastructural development.
Wetlands conservationist Dorothy Weckling says the wetlands are precious resources that cannot be destroyed.
These wetlands are our only source of water. If we take away all our wetlands of Harare, we are taking away our entire water source. what are we going to do for replenishing streams and rivers that feed into the dam wetlands, which are the source of water, should be left alone.
But with the demand for land for housing and shopping malls increasing, Wetlands' plea seems to be falling on deaf ears. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
The three Americans and Britain who tackled gunman Ayub El-Kazani on the Talis train on Friday were awarded France's highest Legion of Honor today. Lisa Bryant has more on the ceremony attended by top diplomats and officials at the LSA Palace in Paris.
Monsieur Alexander Skaratos, au nom de la République française, je vous fais chevalier de la Légion d'honneur.
French President François Hollande pinned the medals on the polo shirts of Americans Spencer Stone, Alex Skarlatos, and Anthony Sadler, and on the suit of Briton Chris Norman. Mr. Hollande embraced the four men and saluted them for their courage.
Voilà quatre hommes qui se sont dressés avec d'autres, non pas simplement pour sauver leur propre vie.
The four not only saved their own lives, Mr. Hollande said, but also avoided a tragedy, a massacre aboard the high-speed train from Amsterdam that carried more than 500 people. He said the entire world admires their courage and cool-headedness in the face of evil that is terrorism.
Au nom de la France, je tiens à vous remercier pour ce que vous avez fait.
Mr. Hollande thanked the four men in the name of France and said their heroism was an example and a source of inspiration for many. The French president also saluted the other passengers who helped to raise the alarm and subdue gunman Ayub El-Kazani, who the president described as a terrorist. That included a French passenger and a Franco-American who has been hospitalized for his wounds. They will receive the Legion of Honor in a separate ceremony. Speaking together to the media for the first time on Sunday, the three Americans described pummeling Kazani to the ground, saying basic survival instinct drove their actions. President Hollande singled out these words by Sadler.
In times of like crisis like that, I would want it to be learned that basically to do something, hiding or sitting back is not going to accomplish anything, and the gunmen would have been successful if my friend Spencer had not gotten up.
French counterterrorism officials continue to question Kazani, a 26-year-old Moroccan known to intelligence services in three countries for links to radical Islam and who may have traveled to Syria. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
This is James Butte, host of Voice of America's Daybreak Africa. Join me Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC for the latest in Africa news, features, and sports. We are also available on the internet at www.voaafrica.com. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show on the Voice of America.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The United Nations envoy to Somalia, Nicholas Kay, is criticizing an effort by some Somali lawmakers to impeach the president. And France's President Francois Hollande and Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel plan to meet today to hammer out long overdue European Union quotas for thousands of migrants and refugees. Coming up, we'll have music from East Africa, and in our feature segment, Muslims in Cameroon are caught between trying to stay safe and practicing their religion. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Ruhib, and we're live from Washington. This is African News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Monday, Sunny.
Happy Monday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are focusing today on the World Athletics Championships.
Kim, Monday marked the third day of competition at the World Championships in Athletics in Beijing, China. Kenya captured gold medals in the women's 10,000 meters race and the men's 3,000 meters steeplechase event. Ladies first. In the women's 10,000 meters, Kenya's Vivian Cheruiyot had a winning time of 31 minutes, 41.31 seconds. Ethiopia's Galeta Berka won the silver medal, while Emily Infeld of the USA won the bronze. It was Cheruiyot's fourth world title. She also won the 10,000 meters gold at the 2011 World Championships in Daegu, South Korea. Also in Daegu, Vivian won the 5,000 meters gold medal, and she also won gold at 5,000 meters at the 2009 World Championships in Berlin, Germany. Vivian Cheruiyot also represented Kenya with distinction at the 2012 London Olympics, winning a silver medal at 5,000 meters and a bronze medal at 10,000 meters. In the men's 3,000-meter steeplechase race Monday, the Kenyans once again dominated the action. Ezekiel Kemboi led a Kenyan sweep of the medals. Ezekiel won his fourth consecutive world title, clocking 8 minutes, 11.28 seconds. Conseslus Kipruto captured the silver medal, while Brameen Kipruto won the bronze. In other results from Beijing Monday, Olympic champion Shelly-Ann Fraser-Pryce of Jamaica again showed off her speed in the women's 100 meters dash final, clocking a winning time of 10.76 seconds. Daphne Schippers of the Netherlands won the silver medal, and Tori Bowie of the USA won the bronze. Nigerian sprinter Blessing Okagbare had a disappointing race, finishing last in the eight women field with a time of 11.02 seconds. Blessing is the captain of Team Nigeria in Beijing, and I know her many fans in Nigeria are hoping she can bounce back later at the World Championships in the women's 200 meters and women's long jump. Meanwhile, Shelly-Ann Fraser-Pryce made history with her victory, becoming the only female athlete to be crowned world champion over 100 meters three times. The Jamaican star also won 100-meter world titles in 2009 and 2013. Fraser-Pryce's victory came one night after Jamaican countryman Usain Bolt scored a dramatic win in the men's 100-meter dash. Bolt came from behind and leaned at the finish line to edge American Justin Gatlin and retain his title as the world's fastest man. Bolt clocked 9.79 seconds, one 100th of a second faster than Gatlin, who got the silver medal. Another American, Trayvon Brommel, won the bronze. It was Usain Bolt's record ninth career gold medal at the World Championships.
I definitely think this was my hardest race. I've been through a lot this season. It's been rough, and Justin has been running great. He's been showing up running fast times, so I know it was going to be easy. It's a championship, and I always say that my coach has told me one thing that I've learned over the years, that Justin Gatlin, when it comes to a championship, he always shows up. So For me, I knew that if I'm going to come in and win, I had to run a great race and well-executed race. So for me, I'm just happy that I got it done, and I'm proud of myself.
Meanwhile, Eritrean athlete Gurmay Gebreselassie has reason to be proud of himself. Gurmay made history in the very first event at the World Championships, the men's marathon. The 19-year-old became the first athlete ever from Eritrea to win gold at a World Championships. The VOA's Nightline Africa sportsman, Segun Dot on the spot Adeyemi, has that story and other news about Beijing 2015.
Good evening, Africa. The 2015 IAAF World Championships started off in Beijing on Saturday. Over 9 days, the Chinese capital is hosting the last major outdoor athletics event before next year's Olympics in Rio, Brazil. On the first day of competition, 4 African countries got onto the medals table. They are Eritrea with 1 gold, Kenya with 1 silver and 1 bronze, Ethiopia with 1 silver, and Uganda with 1 bronze. The highlight of day one was the men's marathon final, which was won by Eritrea. In taking the men's marathon title, teenager Gurmay Gebreselassie won Eritrea's first World Championships gold medal. Gebreselassie, who is just 19 years old, won in 2 hours, 12 minutes and 28 seconds on the streets of Beijing. Silver medalist Yemani Sege of Ethiopia came in with a lifetime best of 2 hours, 13 minutes and 8 seconds. And Solomon Mutai of Uganda finished third in 2 hours, 13 minutes and 30 seconds. Defending marathon champion Stephen Kiprotich of Uganda finished 6th. Africa also did well in the 10,000 meters for men, with Kenya taking the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th places. Staying with the IAAF World Championships, a total of 17 athletes are flying the Nigerian flag in Beijing. The team of 3 males and 14 females will compete in 9 women's and 3 men's events. Olukayode Thomas is the official spokesperson for Team Nigeria in Beijing. In this telephone conversation, I asked Thomas to describe the mood in the Nigerian camp and the medal prospects of Team Nigeria captain and Africa's fastest woman, Blessing Okagbare.
Well, the morale is very high. You know, this is the best of track and field in the world. It's the biggest championship. So for even qualifying to be here, for most athletes, it's a big deal. And we are looking at picking some medals. Then God has also blessed us with an athlete called Blessing Okagbare, who is very hardworking, focused, and she, in the last few years, has put herself on the global map. So the attention is on her and what she will do with the Jamaicans and the Americans in the 100 and 200 meters.
You talked about Blessing Okagbare, who is also Africa's fastest woman, and she is the captain of Team Nigeria. I remember that she won her first Olympic gold medal at the 2008 Beijing Olympics. Will Beijing also be the venue for Okagbare's first World Championships gold medal?
When I asked her the same question, that was what she told me. She said, for all that she has done in this world, the Beijing medal she won in 2008 as a teenager is the most precious to her. But right now, all her focus here is to win a gold medal. And she's been working so hard. She came before everybody. She's been here for about a week before the championship. She's focused, she's cheerful, she's playful. When you see her, you know that she's not tense. She's not arrogant, but confident that, look, I've done all the things I need to do. With God's grace, I'll be a gold medalist.
Well, Nigeria has never won a gold medal at the IAAF World Championships. Will Team Nigeria break the jinx this time?
Well, you know, the unpredictability of sport is the strongest attraction. Sport is very, very unpredictable. But we have a potential gold medalist in our hand. With a 10.79, you can be anything in the world in women 100 meters. So Blessing has what it takes to, and even in the 200, she has what it takes to win the gold medal. She has done the hard work, she has done the training, she has done everything. Every other thing is for luck and grace of God.
That was Olukayode Thomas, the official spokesperson for Team Nigeria at the ongoing 2015 IAAF World Championships in Beijing. no Ghanaian athlete is featuring at the 2015 IAAF World Championships due to visa problems. According to Ghana's athletics governing body, Alex Amankwa and Jeanette Amposa could not represent Ghana due to difficulties in getting a Chinese visa.
Thanks so much for listening. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
Hey, g'day, mates. Remember me? This is the old sports emperor with a red-hot listening tip. That's right. Give a listen to my pal, the bright and lively Sunny Man on the Sunny Side of Sports, right here on the Voice of America.
Thanks, Barry, for that red-hot listening tip. Scorching hot. Put your hand on the burner, and you're going to say, ow, ow, ow. I had a nice phone chat with the old sports emperor last week, and Barry sends his regards to all our Voice of America listeners. Barry is retired now in the southern U.S. state of Georgia. Retired, but not tired. Barry says he keeps busy with his writing and other activities in Georgia. Back to Beijing, and more results on Monday from the 15th IAAF World Championships in Athletics. Shaughnessy Barber of Canada won gold in the men's pole vault with a winning height of 5.90 meters. Rafael Marcel Holzdep of Germany won the silver medal, and Paweł Wojciechowski of Poland won the bronze. In the women's triple jump final, Katarin Ibargwen of Colombia had a gold medal winning leap of 14.90 meters. Hanna Knyazyeva-Menenko of Israel won the silver medal, and Olga Rypakova of Kazakhstan won the bronze medal. After 3 days of competition at the World Championships in Beijing, Kenya tops the medals table with six total, two gold, two silver, and two bronze. If you're just tuning in now to the Voice of America, those Kenyan gold came on Monday. Ezekiel Kemboi won his fourth consecutive world title in the men's 3,000-meter steeplechase, and Vivian Cheruiyot was crowned world champion in the women's 10,000 meters. Jamaica is next on the medals table with three total, two gold and one bronze. The Jamaican gold came in the men's and women's 100-meter dashes as Usain Bolt and Shelly-Ann Fraser-Pryce were the winners. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, Muslims in Cameroon caught between trying to stay safe and practicing their religion. And next, electronic or e-cigarettes growing in popularity among teenagers. But for some music, here is Miriam Chimos from East Africa with Malaika.
Yeah.
Miriam Chimos from East Africa with Malaika.
Well, Muslims in Cameroon are caught between trying to stay safe and practicing their religion in the wake of several suicide bombings in the north of the country. Security has been tightened across the country since suicide bombers killed more than 50 people in the northern cities Maroua and Fotokol in July. Amid fears that they may be harboring members of the Boko Haram terrorist group, Muslim communities are imposing extra measures in their neighborhoods. Eugene Nfongwa visited the largest Muslim neighborhood in the capital, Yaoundé, and reports.
Briquetery lies just south of Cameroon's presidential palace and less than a mile from the country's top police academy. From the outside, nothing has changed in this dilapidated neighborhood, home to the largest Muslim community in Yaoundé. The streets are packed with men and women in long loose gowns and elaborate headgear. In a distance, an imam invites the faithful to the 2 p.m. prayers over a loudspeaker. For many years, the residents here welcome strangers, letting them stay in more than a dozen free shelters for as long as they wanted. But in the wake of several suicide bombings in the north of the country, community and religious leaders have been forced to revise their open-day policies. Amadou Ibrahim, a Quranic teacher at the city's central mosque, says security has become a main concern here and anywhere with a large concentration of Muslims.
In all the mosques that you can find in Yaoundé, in all the 5-time prayers a day, we have certain people that are chosen, whom we trust, who are civilian, not necessarily the policemen or law officers, to be vigilant, even during prayers. They don't take part in prayer, they stand around to look at any suspicious case. And after the prayers, you know, they can now come and perform their own prayer.
The Islamic sect Boko Haram has been blamed for at least 5 suicide bombings in the northern cities of Fotokol and Maroua. Ibrahim say Muslims have been targeted in the attacks and their openness to strangers make them even more vulnerable. The police have posted officers outside mosques and other large gatherings of Muslims across the country as part of measures to stem new attacks. In late July, the military released photos of 4 young women strapped with explosives. The army said the woman had planned another suicide attack in Maroua. 3 young men, all of them Muslims, were also arrested in July, transporting what security forces believe to be explosives in a bag. As public debate rages on Islamic fundamentalism, Ibrahim says religious leaders in the capital have taken steps to prevent the preaching of violence. Imams must now translate their sermons into English or French and are no longer allowed to broadcast their preaching over loudspeakers.
Sometimes, as we said, some of the Muslims, some of the preachers, they use violent method. We cannot deny that. And of course, some of the factions, maybe you also have factions within the Muslim community. This one will insult this insult this. And to solve that problem, the government came in, even through our request. And the government came and said, you don't preach. If you want to listen to preaching, go into the mosque.
Boko Haram has promised more suicide bombings and continues to attack villages and military positions around the Lake Chad area. With no signs of an end to the group's campaign of terror, Muslim scholars and leaders have difficulties upholding Islam as a religion of peace.
And you know, Islam, it lacks strong institutions. And because of their hospitality too, people can infiltrate. So what I can say is that we have an enemy whose aim is not religion. If it is religion, why are they killing people, Muslims?
The leaders of Cameroon and Nigeria promised to eradicate the group at the end of a meeting in Yaoundé last month. But for ordinary people, including Muslims, the pressing problem is how to stay safe while a regional joint force is still taking shape. Reporting for VOA Africa, I am Eugene Fongwa in Yaoundé.
O Over the past several years, electronic or e-cigarettes have grown in popularity. Today, e-cigarette users include a growing number of teenagers, many who have never smoked tobacco. Today, a new study finds that young teens who begin using e-cigarettes are more likely to begin using real cigarettes and other smokable tobacco products. VOA's Carol Pearson reports.
Electronic cigarettes first entered the market as an alternative for adults who wanted to quit smoking. Recently, however, use among teenagers has skyrocketed around the world, and so has concern that e-cigarettes could be a gateway to tobacco use. Adam Leventhal, who specializes in addiction studies at the University of Southern California, is one of the co-authors of a study of teens and e-cigarettes.
They come in attractive flavors, like cotton candy, bubble gum. They're very high-tech, and, you know, they're modern and they're cool.
E-cigarettes, e-cigs, e-hookahs, as they're called, are nicotine delivery devices. They use a liquid solution containing nicotine that's inhaled, a process often called vaping. Leventhal and other researchers surveyed more than 2,000 Los Angeles high school students, starting at the beginning of ninth grade when most are about 14 years old. At that time, none of the students said they smoked tobacco products, but the group included some who had tried vaping.
We compared teens who had used e-cigarettes to teens who hadn't, and we looked to see whether there were differences between those two groups in the initiation of smoking of combustible tobacco products.
The students were surveyed again 6 months later and at the start of 10th grade.
The teens who use e-cigarettes were more than four times more likely to start smoking than the teens who hadn't used e-cigarettes.
Leventhal and others in the health field are concerned that the trend will lead to a new generation of tobacco users. The study was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The global movement to bring Joseph Kony and the Lord's Resistance Army to justice has reached the halls of Congress. More than a dozen members of the U.S. House of Representatives have joined together to introduce a bipartisan resolution condemning Kony and the LRA for continuing to perpetrate crimes against humanity. A similar measure is being considered in the Senate, endorsing current U.S. efforts to support members of the African Union Regional Task Force in hunting down Kony's guerrilla army. It also pledges continued congressional support for U.S. military advisors working with those nations in the region. On August 10th, lawmakers were briefed on efforts to track down and eliminate the LRA and heard testimony from non-governmental organizations that have been working to raise public awareness and assure accountability for atrocities committed by the group. Kony was indicted in 2005 by the International Criminal Court in The Hague, but has evaded capture ever since. For more than two decades, his small, ruthless armed band has terrorized large areas of Uganda, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, South Sudan, and Central African Republic, forcing some 465,000 people to flee their homes. Uganda, where the group originated, and its neighboring countries have struggled for years to counter the LRA. With the support of the African Union, the United Nations, the United States, and other international partners, efforts to end the group's depredations against civilians have seriously weakened, but not yet completely eliminated, the group. The congressional action shows once again that our country stands with the governments and the people of Central Africa in their efforts to neutralize the LRA. We call on LRA fighters to put down their arms, leave the organization's ranks, and come home. We will continue to work with the governments in the region to ensure that low-level fighters and abductees who escape from the LRA are able to reunite with their families and reintegrate into normal society,
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bungany in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Malaria kills thousands of people each year, but there are some simple things you can do to protect your family. If you can, put screens in your windows. A simple screen can keep disease-carrying mosquitoes out of your home. If you go outside, wear light-colored clothing and long pants and long sleeves, especially when it is dark and mosquitoes are most active. After it rains, empty all containers of standing water. The water in just one discarded tire can become a breeding ground for thousands of mosquitoes. Make sure your home is clear of debris and anything that holds water, including discarded cans, water containers, and rubbish. Empty containers that livestock drink from regularly so that mosquitoes cannot breed there.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.